Hi, readers. Welcome to Books Connect Us from Penguin Random House. This is a podcast about staying connected with each other and the stories and authors who inspire us. On today's show, we have authors Nick Stone and Jodi Picoult discussing topics such as white fragility, the difference in expectations for Black women and white women, the problematic nature of colorblindness, and what to do to be a better white advocate. Nick Stone is the critically acclaimed and New York Times bestselling author of Dear Martin, Clean Getaway, and her latest, Dear Justice. Jodi Picoult is the number one New York Times bestselling author of 25 novels, including Small Great Things and The Book of Two Ways. This originally aired on Nick Stone's Instagram channel as part of a series of conversations that she is having about race. And now, here are authors Nick Stone and Jodi Picoult.
I'm going to start with a story because I want people to know how we met.
Yeah.
I was an undergrad at Spelman, and this was 2014, which was the year of what we call Snowmageddon here in Atlanta. There was like this massive ice and snowstorm. You were coming down to interview Dr. Beverly Tatum for your book, Small Great Things. I was a student doing an independent study, and I got invited to a luncheon that Dr. Tatum was going to hold where like a few of us would get to meet you. Of course, everything gets canceled. So I shoot you an email that's basically like, oh, hi, you're in town. There's no way I'm going to pass up the chance to meet you because I'm working, like I want to write a book and I love your work, et cetera, et cetera. And I wound up coming to the luncheon that wasn't really a luncheon anyway. And we connected and you asked, and I basically was like, you're working on this book. I would love to read it for you. And you took me up on the offer.
And something, I was so grateful.
Yeah. I mean, and I appreciate your gratitude, which is actually how I want to jump in tonight. I will be wholly honest. I was petrified reading and critiquing that manuscript because, like, we know who Jodi Picoult is, right? Like, and my little senior in college ass was like, oh boy, this is kind of a big deal. But I did my due diligence because it was important to me that I actually give you what you were asking for, and you were asking me for a critique. And you just took it all in, despite my fear that I was gonna send you this thing back and you were gonna like, be like, who is this girl? You took everything I said in stride. You did the exact opposite of what I see a lot of white people do when they receive critique from people of color. I wanna launch off our conversation talking about white fragility, because I find that in situations where a lot of white people are critiqued, where they face any kind of criticism, there is just this inability to handle it. Where does that come from, Jodi?
So first of all, let me preface this by saying one thing. Whatever I say tonight, when I say we, I'm talking about white people. Like, there is absolutely nothing that me or anyone who looks like me can tell you about racism. And so it's really important, I think, if we're going to have a conversation about race, to acknowledge that I am grateful that you want to have the conversation with me, because it's not your job to educate the people who look like me. And that it's but it's really important that white people show other white people what they can do to continue to grow and to continue this journey. And, you know, when I first met you, I was learning a lot of really terrible things about myself.
Because,
you know, you talk about white fragility, and that I define that as the problem that white people have being told that they have something to do with racism. And for me, I think it's because, you know, we have a really easy binary. Racist equals bad. Can't be racists. And the reason that this completely breaks apart is because people, when they hear the word racist, they think it means prejudice. They think racism is prejudice. And prejudice is only a part of racism. Prejudice is really personal. It is bias, and we all have it. We're swimming in a sea of bias. We grow up conditioned to have prejudices. But the difference between individual bias and racism is the idea of power and who controls all the power in society or a situation. You know, and everyone may have bias, but not everyone has the systemic power to deny rights to another group of people. And so, again, for white people, one way to think about this is the suffrage movement, right?
Yeah.
And I was reading White Fragility this weekend, which I hadn't read, by Robin DiAngelo. It was amazing. And she uses this example in a really good way. You know, we know that there were a lot of women when they were trying to get the vote, you know, back in the early 1900s or whatever, who probably, when they were alone with other women, said really nasty things about men. They have been very against men. But they did not have the power to keep men from voting or to keep men from owning property. Right? Men, however, did have the power to keep women from voting and to keep women from owning property. And so it was on those men to grant that right to women because they held all the power. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the situation we're in with racism. In America, the white people hold all the power. And so it's going to be on the white people to fix that and to make sure that we are giving the rights that every citizen of this country deserves, especially Black people who are truly being underserved by our country right now. Also, little caveat, I'm using a suffrage example, but that's problematic in and of itself. And hopefully we'll talk about that later because there were a lot of Black suffragettes who came and stood up for white women who then did not get the same treatment.
Girl.
Put a pin in that one.
But yes. We'll come back.
So, you know, the thing that I've noticed is, I've been talking a lot about this because I feel like that's one thing that I can do as I continue to learn. Maybe what I can do is pull someone else up that mountain with me. Yeah. And I use my social media and I use my newsletter and I have individual conversations to try to challenge people, particularly the ones who say things to me like, how dare you call me a racist? You don't know anything about me. So I thought I would give you like the highlights of what Jody gets in response to some of her emails. So things I've been hearing a lot in the last week. How dare you call me a racist? I have Black friends. I'll give you a moment to roll your eyes. So, you know, we hear that a lot, right?
Uh-huh.
I bet you hear it more than I do. And one of the things that I always think about is like, great, if you were, right, I'm glad you have a Black friend, great for you. But nobody white wants to be a representative of the whole group, right? So, ooh, you know, you want to be treated that way. You shouldn't be holding your Black friend or two friends up as the representative of all Black people. I also hear things like, well, I'm a minority too. Again, this is really important because I think it gives you a space from which you can begin to have empathy. But when you say that back in response to someone who's asking you, as a white person, what are you doing to combat racism? What you're kind of doing is taking the narrative away from Black people. And that's a big one. That whole recentering the movement around yourself as a white person instead of the Black people where we should be throwing that spotlight, that's something that I still struggle with and I have to constantly think about. I heard a lot of, you know, white privilege, you have no idea how poor I grew up. I hear that a lot. So again, I'm sorry that you did. And there's no way to say that you didn't suffer perhaps growing up, but if you did, it wasn't because of your skin color. You know, so that's. And then there's also, it used to be really, really bad, but Obama. And so my
response, no, bruh, he not here no more.
My response to that is, okay, so if we've fixed racism, would you willingly wake up tomorrow and be treated the way Black people are treated in this country? And very few people pick me up on that. So you know there's still a problem, right? And then the last one, this is the new one this week, is, okay, clearly there's a problem, but we must do something about the loss of property and the riots. So I have a lot of thoughts about this. And so, you know, first of all, when you say that, what you're really doing is a bait and switch.
Yep.
You are, again, taking the focus away from work that you can do to learn how to be a better white person, really. And instead, you're trying to blame someone for a behavior that will, in a way, dehumanize them, as if to say, these people are animals. Clearly, I shouldn't be paying attention to them or be treating them well. So we want to not do that, first of all. The second thing is, I'm sorry, but I can't tell you how many riots happen after, like, an NFL team does
football games. What?
Right?
Right.
I'm sorry. If you're going to riot, I think it's much more reasonable to riot over deaths in your community than about the fact that your team lost. And then, you know, I think that's really important, too. I don't advocate destruction of property. Nobody does. But when you compare that to destroying human life, you know, you're not even talking apples and oranges here.
No.
And to me, I've really been thinking about what was it about sort of this flash paper that ignited this week. And of course, you know, what's been happening with George Floyd, I think he was really the catalyst at the
Absolutely.
End. But think of how, you're talking about hundreds of years that Black people have done what is supposed to be good protesting. You know, peaceful marches, taking a knee, waiting their turn to speak, and voting. And it hasn't done a damn thing. You know, if you had spent 200 years trying to get someone's foot off your back, do you think that you would gently say, excuse me? Or do you think you'd throw yourself up? I mean, I think you have to put yourself in that situation. So again, for all of these reasons, these are the things that I keep hearing now when people are telling me I shouldn't be saying you're racist. The thing that I think is so hard for white people is that although we can see that it's, if you're Black in America, you are going to have certain challenges, for some reason, it's really hard for us to admit that if you're white in America, you're going to have advantages. Because we really like that individualistic system of, I worked super hard, I deserve everything I got. And if you buy into the belief that racism is systemic, it means that there's a system that's given you a massive boost above someone else.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I feel like that's what white fragility is. It is that fear that once we begin to look very carefully in the mirror, we're going to realize we're part of a system that has been very oppressive, and that it really is on us to make changes that are ultimately going to make life harder for us white people.
Yep. It's like textbook imposter syndrome, and I find it so fascinating. And it's so a phrase that's been kicking around in my head that has a lot to do with what we're talking about right now is I've had this term, this discomfort threshold. There's mm-hmm. such a low threshold for discomfort among a lot of white Americans. And it's like, I know going into spaces, I did, God, where was I? I was at like a book conference something. I'm in a room with probably 600 people. The first thing I said when I got up to the podium is, raise your hand if you're Black. Yes. My hand went up and two others in the whole room. Yeah. And mm-hmm. it was like,
yeah,
how many of you white people are uncomfortable now?
Mm-hmm.
Every hand went up. And then I said, how do you think I feel? And I think it's one of those things where it is exactly what you're talking about. There is this failure to empathize. There's this failure to think like, hey, wait a minute. It's possible that this person is uncomfortable and is maybe feeling uncomfortable all of the time, whereas I don't like this discomfort sometimes. And right. I think it's such an interesting thing to me. And you see the ways that systemic racism has made life comfortable for white people. And yeah. I want white people to start acknowledging that a little more. Please and thank you.
Sorry. And I think, you know, what you just talked about, it's rare that a white person finds him or herself in a situation where that face is not the primary color.
Absolutely.
This is a white world, you know? When you go to get a Band-Aid, it matches my skin, not yours. When you look at greeting cards, my family is represented, not yours. When you read a newspaper, do you ever see someone identified as so-and-so, comma, white? No, but you see so-and-so, comma, a Black man, right? You know, the world is, the default is white. And I think it's really important, first of all, to say why
yep.
that happened, because of just letting it happen, I think you need to ask that. But I want to actually say that when I was doing research for a different book, for A Spark of Light, one of the great privileges I had was spending time with Dr. Willie Parker.
Mm-hmm.
And I was down in Mississippi and Alabama with him. And he was great. I love him. And one night he goes, and oh, I should say he's an African-American abortion provider. That's an important part of the story.
Very.
So he says to me, hey, my brother's having a barbecue. Do you want to come? And I'm like, yes. I go to his house. And there are, I thought a barbecue, there's like going to be 5 or 6 people there. His brother's family was 55 people.
Absolutely.
All of them black, of course, you know, and I'm like sitting there like, oh my gosh, they're going to, what are they going to think of me? And it was a really, you know, arresting moment. Cause I was like, I'm so terrified. What if I say the wrong thing? What if they, you know, what if I offend someone and I don't mean to? And I got to tell you, they couldn't have been more lovely. The food could not have been better.
You know, you ate real good. I know you ate real good.
Oh, I did. And I was like, I remember actually my son was about to get married and I actually turned to someone, a cousin. And I was like, you guys have more food here than we're planning at a wedding for like huge people. It was such a fun and amazing and eye-opening night. You know, and if white people can put themselves in situations where they feel uncomfortable, as weird and itchy as you get, that is going to help you really take giant leaps and bounds forward in ending what other people's lives are like in this country.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And so interestingly enough, I remember when I was reading Small Great Things, when I was reading like early drafts and the relationship between our lawyer and our nurse. Was such a fascinating one. And we ended up having some really great conversations about the lives of Black women versus the lives of white women. So I want to dig into this. Like, I want to dig in because I have you, you are beautifully, openly feminist, but not in an exclusionary way, which I really appreciate. And there is a very sour history between mm-hmm. Black women and white women. I will be straight up. There are not a lot of white women I trust. I love you. I trust you. I will text you if I'm like, Jody, I hate everything. I can name like,
yeah,
maybe 5 or 6.
Wow.
I'm really I'm like texting consistently, whatever. Like I have like my white girlfriends. Mm-hmm. But there's such a different experience, like being a Black woman and being a white woman, there's such a different experience where I am expected to be strong. I am expected to be able to take care of myself at like 11 or 12 years old. I'm expected mm-hmm. to be able to handle things if something goes awry for me. There's this kind of protected nature of white womanhood that I would love to hear you address, especially in light of the fact that you wrote both of these characters. You wrote a Black woman and you wrote a white woman in the same book. How was it different writing those two characters?
It was terrifying writing a Black woman. You know, because
I'm actually glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that.
Well, you know, if you're writing a Black woman and you're white and you're not terrified, there's something seriously wrong with you.
Absolutely. I completely agree.
You know, it's not my lived experience. And I am incredibly grateful to you and to the other women that I spoke with and met with and stole your stories and braided them together and then had you reduce sensitivity reads of the book. I wouldn't have published that book if I hadn't had that.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a whole like special, we could go on another 3-hour tangent about publishing and the right to write and how you can do it responsibly. And I, from a white woman's perspective, what I can tell you is that I thought very hard about writing Small Great Things. Mm-hmm. And ultimately the reason I wrote it was to address white people. I am thrilled when someone Black writes me and says, this is my experience. That's a real huge compliment to me and a feather in your cap. But it is, it's meant for white people. It's meant for white people to read and see themselves in, you know? Mm-hmm. And ultimately, when I was writing Ruth, she was my favorite character, which I also liked. I mean, I saved
she's
all
fabulous.
The you know, and she's really complex and I love that. You know, to me, Kennedy was easy. She was the default. She's the me I was for almost 50 years of my life. That was very easy to write. And so, do you have little ones out there?
Just invades every life. He invades everything I have done the past few days. Okay. Go to bed. Good night.
I don't know. Nick, you didn't tell me I could bring my props, you know.
I'm just saying, like, just he just walks in, no qualms.
Gosh, I remember when he wasn't out yet, so, you know.
Yes. Lord.
But to go back to like the idea of Black women and white women, I think, have a really complicated history.
Absolutely.
That's something that comes down to intersectionality. And that's a term that some people might not know about. That's kind of where, to me, it's the point, the crossroads between race and class and gender and sexuality and ability. And like every other crossroads, it's a tender spot that's easier to break.
Yep.
And, you know, we talked about suffrage before, right? I told you there was a problem with that. Well, here was the problem. There were a lot of Black suffragettes. Mm-hmm. A lot of people do not even know that.
Yep.
They didn't make their way into the history book because history is always written by the winners and the winners are always white. And, you know, white women get the right to vote in 1919, okay? So Black voting rights weren't really secure until 1965. And yet nobody talks about the fact that after white women could vote, they didn't vote on things like amendments that would give formerly enslaved people, you know, citizenship rights or Black men voting rights. They didn't show up for the Black women who showed up for them. And that's a history that, you know, it's continuing. It's still, we can't just throw that out. We can't throw out the fact that that happened. And that's only like a tiny piece of it, because when you look at other movements, for some reason, Black faces and voices are often eroded. You know, you see this in feminism all the time. Black feminists are often ignored. Feminism is considered sometimes to be too white. Mm-hmm. In the gay rights movement, there are so many people who were Black who moved that forward, and Black trans women in particular, who are almost completely ignored. You know, so it's like, for some reason, the Black women in particular always get the short end of the stick, because mm-hmm. the other with intersectionality is that, you know, it's like getting the shit heap dumped on you twice, basically.
Yeah.
So,
for example, absolutely. Black,
right? So you, because you're a woman, you are making less money than men do at the same job. And because you're a Black woman, you're making less money than white people do at the same job. So now you've got that, Word. You know, grounded, right. You know, and that we should mention too, that you're doing a full week of talks about race with people to educate people, which you don't have to do. You're not making money off this.
Not a damn cent. And it was right. my initiative, because I want people to start talking. Which, can we please talk for a second about Amy What's-A-Face, Amy Caringhead, okay? I'm not gonna say her whole name because it does not deserve to be said. So she weaponized her tears, right? Mm-hmm. Because this goes into exactly what we're talking about. A thing that I see a lot from white women is, you got the fragility, first of all. Take the fragility, add this manipulative thing where I'm going to cry so that you feel what I'm feeling, so that you okay. see what I'm feeling and you feel bad for me. Mm-hmm. I'm not with it. Let me just, like, I have no problem hurting white yeah. girl feelings. I'm gonna mm-hmm. say it again. I have no problem hurting white girl feelings, because yeah. I think it's important that white women, mm-hmm. y'all gotta be just as tough as we are. It is what it is, right? So you have this Amy Karen lady who called the police on this Black man
yeah.
in Central Park.
This
and lied on camera. Like the fact that she lied on camera, I'm like, bro, this is a new level of audacity. This man is filming you, clearly not doing anything to yeah. you. And you are so wrapped up in your foolishness that you are lying on camera. Okay, she loses her job. Rightfully so. The number of people I saw caping for this woman about how she shouldn't have lost her job, it was unfair, et cetera, et cetera. Where I don't get paid to do this stuff. The debut Who thing that I started, I'm not getting paid for that. Nobody, no publishing companies are giving me marketing dollars for promoting their books. But I feel like there is this expectation that white people are going to continue to get this free labor. But at the same time, I can't not do it because I feel a responsibility. So it's like I have this conflict where, in a way, I'm perpetuating the stereotype by mm-hmm. providing this free labor yeah. where you have white women who cry and get out of things. Mm-hmm. Talk to your girls, Jody.
Okay. So this is like this is the white woman's tears thing. And you know, you talk about this, the first, that she did this on camera, and how could she even do this? Like, this is a historical first. Well, that's total BS, because this goes all the way back to Emmett Till, and I'm sure way before that, right? So what you have are, again, history. We can't divorce ourselves from history. You've got these white women who have, they do something, they get caught in the act of doing something egregious. And who suffers? The black man, usually, okay?
Yep.
Now, what's worse is that then they get caught. So what do? They burst into tears. Nothing brings everything to a screeching halt like a white woman who's crying.
Oh, girl.
That's it. And, you know, the bottom is that, keep in mind, there's a black man who has been wrongfully accused or wrongfully targeted. A woman starts sobbing. And what happens? All of the focus goes where? Right back to the woman. Right. And so now everyone is falling all over themselves to try to help the white woman, to make her stop crying, to say, it's okay, you're going to get past this. Everyone has now completely ignored the fact that there's still a black man who was wrongfully targeted. And that kind of goes back to, you know, again, that recentering. It's really easy sometimes, even when you're doing it well, I think, and when you're trying really hard to continue a journey of anti-racism, it's really easy to sometimes focus it on yourself.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, like, I'm seeing a lot of that on social media right now. Today was Blackout Tuesday, right? So there are a lot of people who posted that little black square and are doing it because they want to be caught in the act of looking like a good person. Ooh. Again, that binary, you know, I think, like, that good is not racist, bad is racist. And they're thinking that there's this belief that, oh, if I post that black square, people are going to know I'm on the right side here. But they're not really doing anything, you know? I think that it's really important to consider what you're doing beyond that. What have you done to educate yourself today if you posted the black square? You know, who are you talking to? Did you donate somewhere? Did you join a protest? Did you sign up to vote? There are like a bazillion ways that you can make change. And we can talk about that later. But, you know, I think it's really important to recognize that when you post something on social media, particularly about this right now, I know a lot of white people are feeling super frustrated. Try to do it in a way that doesn't draw attention to you as pat yourself on the back, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe use the words of someone of color who you've read, who you really admire. You know, maybe a quote from a book that you've read that moved you deeply and why it moved you. I think honest words are really important. And it's okay to even say, I don't have the words. But again, don't make it about you. And, you know, the thing about the white woman's tears, again, is that there's the kind where a white woman starts crying because she's so upset by what happened. And she uses these terrifying words like, I felt attacked. I felt threatened. Right. I felt threatened. And, you know, words matter.
Absolutely.
And words like that are meant, again, like I said, to dehumanize the person that they wrongfully targeted. She made the mistake, but she's going to use words that make other people think he was doing something that she deserved to, you know, get upset about. So there's that kind of tears. And then there's the other tier of the person who realizes they did something terribly wrong. And they're like, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And again, both of them have the same effect. People fall all over each other to help the white woman. Here's the other problematic thing. You know, white men will go and help the white women. Black men will want to go help the white women. But historically, that doesn't work out so well for them.
That's not a good move.
And then they're kind of caught in, do I have to help the person who just hurt me? Or, you know, and it's a real, you're putting everyone in a really, really weird situation. There is one last kind of tears, which I think is worth talking about.
Mm-hmm.
As sometimes when you are learning something about yourself that's really terrible, like the fact that you've been contributing to racism for, you know, 20, 30, 40 years of your life, and you didn't have your eyes open to recognize that white privilege, I think that sometimes you start crying.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, I had the privilege of taking a racial justice workshop, which was really eye-opening for me and really upsetting. And had I started sobbing in the middle of that workshop, it would have been for a very good reason.
Yeah.
But still would have recentered everything on me.
Yep.
So even if you're doing like the really hard work on yourself, if you start to feel overwhelmed, maybe it, in that last moment, have the grace to pull yourself out and go to the bathroom and cry in private.
Yeah, yeah, I completely agree. And I say this as a person, a human being, who is not allowed to cry in public. I am not allowed as a Black woman. If I cry in public, it's a problem. I'm hysterical. There's something wrong with me, right? If I am able to stuff it down until I get home, white girls, you can do this too. I promise. I promise that you can. I want to also talk about, you mentioned earlier, we were talking about.
I want to say one thing. I want to acknowledge that there is this need, it's not a need. It's almost like this weird requirement for perfection. I think that Black women have to walk around being perfect all the time.
Yep.
You know, I know Michelle Obama's talked about it, but I remember a woman in the racial justice workshop I was in talked about it, that you have to have this mask on your face so that you're the kind of Black woman other people can handle. Because God forbid you open up your mouth, because then you're uppity, you know, or God forbid you don't open your mouth, because then you're disinterested, you know, and it's like, I don't, honestly.
Or you're angry, or you're, you talk too much. Like,
yeah.
Okay. Yes. We were talking earlier, you mentioned that there are certain people who will throw out the like, oh, well, I'm a minority too. To me, this kind of plays into you leaving, Jay Space. You want to come give me a quick hug? My nephew's leaving.
Aww.
I have a house full of Black boys right now. Come on, come quick, because I'm working right now. All right. I'll see you later, okay? Will you close the door on your way out? So I lump this idea in with the very problematic notion concept of colorblindness. Like, I'm colorblind. I don't see color. And I want to tell a story. I was the only Black girl in most of my high school classes. There was one class in particular. It was like a gifted language arts something something. And our teacher claimed to be colorblind. And we were reading... Oh, what were we reading? We were probably reading, I think we were reading Tom Sawyer. And she read The N-Word aloud in class. And it was one of those situations where I'm like, oh, this is colorblindness. Colorblindness is basically saying, oh, I don't see color, so I'm going to treat you like I would other white people. There is no recollection or no acknowledgement at all of the fact that, like, maybe what I'm saying is hurtful. And I want you to address this notion of colorblindness, and let's talk about this.
Yeah. So when I think about colorblindness, I actually think of something that most white mothers with children have experienced. Which is, your three-year-old is in the grocery store and points to a Black person and says, look at that person's skin. It's brown or it's black or whatever, you know? And what usually happens? What do you usually see the white person do?
She goes, shh, 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 shh. Don't say that.
Right. Okay. So you're not supposed to talk about someone's skin color. So, and usually what the white woman will say is, you know, the color of someone's skin doesn't matter. We're all or, you know, that to me is the color blindness. That idea that, you know, it doesn't, it's, we're all the same.
We all bleed red.
Right. So here's the deal. First of all, I get it. I mean, I'm sure I even said that because I didn't know any better at the time. And that's really important too. Like, acknowledge I screwed up for like literally 50 years of my life. I am so a work in progress, but you know, but at least I know I was wrong. And the thing is, first of all, that you have to unpack that one a little bit. Why are you shushing your kid? Do you think that Black person doesn't know that he or she has Black skin?
Bruh, and that we didn't hear it. Like, clearly I can hear your child talking. Right.
But also it's like, it's not going to be a surprise to you that you're Black.
Absolutely not. Like, yes, I did wake up in this body this morning.
So when you shush your kid, you're doing it because on some cultural level, we believe that that is rude. It's rude to talk and tell someone they're Black. It's rude to say that. Well, that points to the implication that Black is bad.
Yep.
Black is a bad thing. So immediately now, you have a three-year-old, and without meaning to, you've reinforced black is bad, white is good in their head.
Yep.
And when you say to someone, like you said, I don't even see color, I'm colorblind, what I think you're really saying, or what I imagine you as a black woman here, is you don't even care enough to notice that the color of my skin is going to make my life different from and more difficult than yours.
Yep.
So even though you think you're saying like this totally awesome, progressive, anti-racist thing, you're not, because you're whitewashing it. You're literally whitewashing it. So like, what is something you could say instead to your 3-year-old? What do I wish I had said to my 3-year-old? And I wish I had said, you know what? That man's skin is a different color than yours. And because of that, some people may not treat him as well or as fairly. So what are some ways that you might make sure that doesn't happen if you ever see it? Mm. You know, use it as a teaching moment.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It's such a fascinating thing when I see it, because it also, it kind of promotes this notion of assimilation, right? Mm-hmm. Color blindness is a thing mm-hmm. that promotes the idea that there is one way to be, yeah. and we all are supposed to be this way. And there's mm-hmm. no acknowledgement that the way that we are supposed to be is white, is societally white. And I've always found it so interesting as a person who has occupied a lot of, a black person who has occupied a lot of white spaces, how few people were willing to acknowledge my color, willing to acknowledge my blackness, and therefore unwilling to acknowledge me, because this is a part of who I am. A word for teachers, I'm just gonna say this real quick. Please don't ever read the N-word aloud in your classroom, period. I don't care what book you're reading. You could be reading my book or Angie's book. If it's got an A on the end or an ER on the end, do not read it aloud. Mm-hmm. For the love of all that is holy, bleep it out. You can still explain the context. You can still, your kids can read. They can hear it in their heads. You don't need to say it aloud. But yeah, no, I think about how I even erased myself for a long time because of this notion of colorblindness. So like, you telling me you don't see color means that I can't either, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, I need to make sure that I'm not acknowledging my mm-hmm. own color, because mm-hmm. if I acknowledge my color, I'm going to make you uncomfortable and you don't actually want to see color and you have all the power. So I need to make sure mm-hmm. that I'm not making you uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those mm-hmm. really frustrating things. We mentioned earlier, you mentioned actually black perfectionism, but I want to talk about white perfectionism, because white perfectionism is like a whole other thing. And I often feel like white perfectionism leads to inaction in situations like this one, where there's this like, well, I'm white and I don't know what to say, so you don't say anything. And mm-hmm. and yeah, let me preface this by saying, yeah, sometimes you're gonna say the wrong thing, and that's okay. It's always just an opportunity to learn something. But talk about white perfectionism and why you think people are led to inaction because they quote unquote don't know what to do.
So on its, putting the best face on it, white perfectionism leads to white paralysis because people don't want to offend.
Yep. Okay.
Okay. So I mean, I'm going to give people the benefit of the doubt. There are terrible human beings out there who are like, I really don't give a crap about racism, and I don't care about this movement. I don't think it's my job. I don't think I have anything to do with it. So I'm not going to follow it or post about it or care.
Yeah.
But I think there are a lot of really good-hearted, well-meaning white people who just do not know what to do.
Yeah.
Really scared of saying the wrong thing. And that is, it's a legitimate fear, because, you know, like, here I am, listen to what I've said tonight. I've said, you've got to make a difference. You got to do better. Don't post that black square. Whatever you post, make sure that it's not about you. I mean, already, there are probably white people going, oh my God, what am I supposed to do? You know? Scary. It's scary that you're going to do something wrong and offend someone. And there are a couple things that can happen, because I've had both things happen. Someone black might say to you, you really shouldn't do that. And here's why. It made me feel not great. And in the best case scenario, if someone says that, hope I would say, Thank you so much for telling me that. I didn't know that. I know better now, and I'm going to rephrase that. I'm going to learn from that and move forward. Okay, so that is the best circumstance that could happen if you say something wrong. Now, there are also moments, and oh, I should also say, if you're a white person and you see someone white doing something that is kind of off, talk to them. It's kind of your job to police them. No, it's not
please,
your job.
Please talk to them.
You don't have to, Nick. I'm going to do that for you. And so the thing is that the worst case scenario is when someone who is very hurt and exhausted and tired of being black, which I imagine probably feels a lot like slamming your head into a brick wall every single day, right? So, and that's, I'm just going on what I imagine. I don't know what it's like.
You are
someone who's tired, but someone who's really tired goes, you're an idiot, and says something really mean and hurtful in response to something you've written that maybe you didn't mean to hurt. What's hard as a white person is having the grace to take a deep breath and say, this is not reverse discrimination, which is not a thing. It might be prejudice at that moment, but it's not reverse discrimination. And it's not hate. It's not someone out to get me. And they're not doing this to hurt me. They're doing it because they're hurt. It's really hard to not feel, again, there's that word, attacked, threatened, you know, but Black people have dealt with crap for hundreds of years. They're allowed to sometimes say, you're being stupid to a white person. And as a white person, sometimes you just have to shut up and say, got it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yeah, you gotta, someone just said, you gotta listen and learn. You gotta listen. Sometimes the most important thing you can do as a white person is listen. And if you don't have the words, listen to someone who does. That's a really good way to start an anti-racism journey, for sure. The other thing is, I think it's important to say something.
Yeah.
Even if you don't have the right words, say that. Say, speak from your heart. Say, I am really upset by watching everything, and I realize I got a lot of work to do here, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry on behalf of people who aren't treating Black people the way that they should be treated. And I'm sorry that I took so many years of my life to learn this. Say those things, you know, because I can't think of a single Black person who wouldn't be like, all right, well, at least they're starting somewhere, right? You know,
maybe, I don't know. There are some who would completely shut it down, but I do think, but that's okay, right? Like, yeah. I think one of the most important things white people can do right now is toughen the F up. And I don't say that with shade or with, like, I'm just being very, very honest. I have spent my entire life having to be prepared for rejection. I have spent my entire life having to be prepared for somebody to slam a door in my face. You know what? I keep going. Dear Martin was my third novel. The first two, they didn't get published. Door slam, door slam, door slam. If I'd given up, I wouldn't be here, right? And I think it's important that white people come to realize that, wait, I actually can take this. I can take somebody telling me that I'm wrong. I can take somebody telling me that I'm not doing this correctly. I love being Black, right? Like, it is one of my favorite things. It's probably my favorite. Actually, Black woman is like my favorite thing about being me, but Black is like right up there. Just Black person is right up there. What I'm tired of is constantly feeling like I have to tone it down or like pander or like make sure the white people are comfortable. I love you white people. I do, but y'all gotta toughen up, bro. Like, it's sometimes you're gonna get things wrong, and that's okay. And even if you're trying hard and people are not responding well to your good intentions, you're okay, I promise.
White people aren't used to being told they're doing anything wrong a lot of the time.
Word.
So it kind of is like a slap in the face when it happens. And, you know, especially when you think you're saying something right or you're doing something right, it's hard to hear that maybe you didn't.
Yeah.
But again, a learning experience. And I think the other thing is there are a lot of people out there who are paralyzed and white because they just do not know where to start.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of important. Like, if you'll indulge me, I would love anyone who's white, who's listening, to hear, here are some ways that I think you might want, right?
Yeah.
So there are lots of things that you can think about. Let's start by saying, okay, you know what? You posted your black square today. What are you going to do tomorrow to help educate yourself? What are you going to do a month from now? What are you going to do in a year when we're not protesting anymore? How are you going to make a difference? Mm-hmm. How support the Black Lives Matter movement? Are you doing like, you know, a monthly donation, maybe? Are you joining, standing up for racial justice, you know, working with white people to somehow work with Black leaders to help them in some way? Yeah. You know, are you signing a petition if you have no money to donate? Are you going out and forming a wall with your white body so that protesters aren't going to be hurt by anybody? And then there's, are you voting? Are you registered to vote? Everyone register to vote.
Please, God.
And then there's everyday stuff that you can do if you kind of train your brain that way. Because I like to say that no matter what you do in life, no matter whether you are a business executive or you're the head of Amazon, you know, or you're a stay-at-home mom, there is something that you can do to make sure that you are moving the needle forward for racial justice, right? So like, let's say you're in a business meeting. If you notice that the people who tend to talk are a bunch of white men, make sure that there's someone of color who speaks up. If there's not someone in that room, talk to HR and get someone of color hired. But if there is someone in the room, give them that amplification to have their voice heard in some way, you know? If you are a mom of a kid, a white mom, go into your kid's class and ask their teacher what they're teaching them about Black history this year. And if it's just February, or if maybe it could extend beyond February and throughout the whole curriculum, is it just going to be about enslaved people? Or are you going to talk about like inventors and heroes and things like that? You know, that's something anyone can do who has a kid. And it's even better if you're white and you ask that question.
Yeah.
You know, really holding usually a white teacher accountable. I think that something that you can do right away is look at your bookshelf. I say this all the time when I talk about this. How often are you reading authors who do not look like you? Mm. Because you are missing so much good literature if you're not. And that's something that you can do today. You can jump off this conversation. You can go support your local indie bookshop, and you can go buy a book by an author of color and read it. And yeah, like for example, Stone, which I'm kind of wondering why I haven't seen Dear Justice yet. Just saying, Nick.
I 100% asked them to send you one. So if you didn't get one, I'm on it.
Yeah. Nick, you're an amazing writer. I mean, you know, I did meet you and you were a baby writer. And I can't believe how prolific you are. You all, she does not sleep, this woman. And it's true. I don't know how you're doing this with little kids, but you are incredibly prolific, and you've written so many, I think, amazing books that bring social justice down to a level that kids can understand it, both middle grade kids and older kids in high school. You've opened up a lot of conversation in schools that were not happening before. So I'm incredibly proud of you. Plus, my God, you wrote the comic book of Shuri.
No!
Come on! Yes.
That was fun.
Yeah.
That was fun.
So again, you know, buy Nick's book or go buy any other book that is going to teach you about your own white privilege. You know, like I said, I just read White Fragility. I absolutely loved it. You can get a book like How to Be Anti-Racist or The New Jim Crow or Waking Up White, or read anything by Ta-Nehisi Coates. You know, there are so many amazing nonfiction books out there that can help you reevaluate who you are as a human being and how to be a better human being. And then I would say jump into fiction, because that's how you really get to see the lives of people who aren't you.
Yep.
This morning, on my Kindle, I woke up and Britt Bennett's book had downloaded, and I can't wait to read it.
I get to talk to her next week. I can't wait.
Well, tell her I said I love her work.
Oh, I absolutely will.
I love The Mothers, and I'm really looking forward to The Vanishing Half. And that's something that I really try to do. I do look at my bookshelves, and I try to make sure that when I'm reading stuff that is representative of people who look very different from me.
Yeah.
you know, and it's important, not just really, not just only because it helps me learn. It also supports the careers and the advancement of writers who are minorities.
Yep.
And publishing, we need that. You know, one of the things that drives me crazy about publishing is that there are a lot of people who think, well, you know, there are Black imprints now, so we're all better, right? Racism's gone. And I don't get that. I don't understand why we expect Black kids to read about white children in books. But white kids can't, what, they can't read a book with a Black hero?
They can't relate. Get out of here.
Yeah. So, and it just doesn't make sense to me. So I think that's really important. I mean, you're reading about, that's the bottom line. You're reading about humans, and you might actually learn something about an experience you didn't have. Right. You know, so all of those are things, hopefully, that people, white people who watch this tonight can kind of take with them and do something. They might feel empowered.
Yeah. And yeah, please read fiction, because you also just get to see Black people being people. And I think that's really important. I'm going to take a couple of audience questions. Jody, how do we talk to our white family members who just don't get it? Get your uncles.
There's always an uncle, right? The crazy.
There's always an uncle.
Always an uncle.
Uncle Jed. Jed, gotta go.
So, you know, bottom line is, this is kind of hard for white people too. We're conflict avoidant a lot of the time. So, you know, we're like, okay, well, you know, Uncle so-and-so made a racist joke. I'm just gonna pretend I didn't hear that. So sometimes you do have to call them out on it. I recommend doing it. Just jump in and say, hey, Uncle Ted, that is not cool. And here's why. And, you know, Uncle Ted may not be ready to hear that message, but there's an excellent chance that Uncle Ted has never been called on that behavior in his life. And maybe you will get him to shut up. Oh. So, you know, one of the hard things I've found about really stepping up to the line is that you will lose people along the way. If you really want to be an ally, you have to recognize that there are going to be some people who don't get it and who don't like what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And I'm a writer. I have a livelihood from selling books. And I get a lot of people who write me and say, how dare you call me a racist? I am never buying one of your books again. And you know what? Sorry, bye. You know, it's okay.
It's a whole bunch of other people who will. Bye-bye. You good.
It's okay. They're not ready to hear that message.
Right.
And 10 years from now, they will remember the crazy white lady who called them on their behavior, and they will think twice. And if they don't buy another one of my books, okay. But I'm willing to take that risk because I think the greater good is worth it.
Yeah, I completely agree.
You know, do that with your family member. Take the risk.
Yes. Okay, let's see. Oh, as a teacher, what's the best way to call out a white student who often overshadows other voices? That's a darn good question.
That's a really good question. So I haven't been a teacher in about 30 years. I wish I had my daughter or my son here. They're both excellent teachers who, but I think what's important, again, would be to make sure that as the teacher, you give the amplification to the student whose voice is not being amplified. You know, that's the best I could do. I can't tell you the right way to do that because I don't know enough about classroom management.
Yeah.
But if there's someone who's hogging the microphone, you take the microphone away.
A word.
What would you say?
This is a tricky one because I'm so used to being the voice that gets overshadowed. I don't have an answer. I am still very much learning how to use my voice. It is terrifying in every sense of the word. Yesterday, I sent a couple of very pointed emails to people in pretty intense positions of authority that could really mess up my money, if I'm being honest. And I was so anxious afterwards that I like had to make a cocktail. Like I was like, oh God, it worked out well. But as a person who's still learning how to use my voice, I don't know how to tell other people to be quiet. Like it's just not a skill that I've learned yet.
Yeah.
I mean, look, if it's getting out of control, I'll probably say some foul stuff, which would get you in trouble as a teacher. So don't do that. But there is, I do think, what I will say, while it's important to uplift and to give space for voices of color, yes, ask their permission first. Because I will also say that as a student, mm-hmm, there were times when I got called on that I didn't really want to, yeah, talk, you know? So I think that consent is something that we also, we're going to have to like start addressing when it comes to this, mm-hmm, conversation and these changes we're trying to make. Because, yeah, what's tricky here is that Black people cannot undo racism.
Yeah.
Right. White people got to undo racism. Mm-hmm. However, we've had to kind of carry this torch and carry this burden for so long. We are terrified, yeah, about trying to hand it over to y'all because we don't like, I, as I mentioned, there just aren't a whole lot of white people that I trust. So now having to trust,
yeah,
the people who have oppressed for so long to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. It's really scary. So teacher who is trying to get your students to make space for other students to speak,
yeah,
I think that a thing that you could do is, like Jody said, take the mic. Like, okay, mm-hmm, I'm not going to call on you today.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Chill out. We're going to call on someone else. And I, right, think, and you do have the authority to do that in the classroom.
I think the other thing that's really important is, because you kind of touched on this, there is sometimes a tendency for a white teacher to make sure, again, trying to do the right thing, to call on the Black child in the classroom as the representative Black voice. And you want it, you know, because that's going to make that child very, very uncomfortable.
Yes.
So you got to, I think it is a really careful balance. I'm glad you pointed that out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Oh, this is a good one. As a student, this is like the last one because we only have like a couple minutes left. A student, what is the, mm-hmm, best way to call out your teacher when they say racist crap?
I want you to answer that.
So I'm that student. What's interesting, right? While it was difficult for me when I was younger and even a little bit now, it's like every time I learn how to use my voice in a space, when I progress to a new space where there's a different power structure, you have to learn how to do it again.
Yeah.
With a teacher, I would call in before calling out in front of a classroom because I've seen that kind of thing backfire. So maybe approaching the teacher after class first. I also am a person who's going to say, like, keep yourself safe in the classroom. As a Black student, knowing how Black kids are, mm-hmm, viewed, knowing how there is a stigma kind of attached to being a Black teenager, there's this expectation that you're grown, you know what you're saying, you know what you're doing.
Right.
And then I think about like the school to prison pipeline and how there's already kind of this idea attached to being a Black kid in a classroom that you're going to be some kind of trouble, like there's potential for you to be a troublemaker. So I am always going to say, don't put yourself in a situation. And I got to work through this, but like, calling in, like approaching the teacher after class, I think would be the first step. And then if it continues, then you call them out in front of the class, I would think, is what I would say. Now, like I said, this is something I need to think about a little bit more. But I do think it's important that teachers, y'all stay open to what your students have to say is the thing. Because I think part of our fear in the classroom is this authority structure. So not only are we contending with, because honestly, I have no problem calling out a Black teacher. Like me and my Black teachers, we always rocked. Like we always vibed. And even when we didn't vibe, there was kind of an understanding that like, I could say some stuff to you that you're not gonna let these white kids say to you. Like I knew that that was the case. But when you combine whiteness with a position of authority, it's really tricky. So teachers, make sure your students know that they can call you out if you say something messed up. Like that's the safest thing you can do in a classroom to make a classroom safe, is let your students know that like, yo, I'm white, y'all are Black. I'm gonna mess up sometimes. And you can let me know if I have messed up. One of my favorite teachers, he was in here. I don't know if he's still in here. He's actually a Black guy, but I actually Skyped with him and two students yesterday, and they were going off on him. These two seventh grade girls were going off on him about toxic masculinity. And I was like, oh,
wow,
this is the kind of, and it was awesome. So we have 50 seconds left. What are your final thoughts?
Wait, I have to add one more thing. I think Please. It's really for education that I hope we start to see more Black teachers. I think that's really important. Representation matters hugely.
Yeah.
And to see someone who looks like you at the top of a class, and that will make it easier, I think, to find an ally in your school who might listen to you if another teacher is not listening to you. If you can't find a Black ally teacher, then find a white one. Hopefully they'll be cool. Final thoughts. If you are
20 seconds.
If you're white, find some way to learn something this week that's going to teach you about your privilege.
Thank you for listening to Books Connect Us. For more great book recommendations and information about your favorite authors, feel free to follow Penguin Random House on social media or visit penguinrandomhouse.com. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard, go ahead and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, as it helps more listeners to find our show. This podcast is produced by Pat Stango and edited by Clayton Gumbert. I've been Erin Leaf, and until next time, this has been Books Connect Us.